dangers also. Our danger is that we exploit the present on the costs of the future, and that is that our children have to pay for our pleasure. In a time of overpopulation and of the limits of growth, this temporal perspective of human rights assumes particular significance, I believe. Now, my last point again is theological, more theological, specific Christian theological. Human rights are only effective insofar as people are truly human and act humanly. Their inhumanity becomes manifest in the violations and abuse of human rights. This is why, behind the practical question as to how human rights may be realized on earth, there is the more profound question as to where people can experience their true humanity and how they can overcome their actual inhumanity. Some cynics say the only universal thing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a universal violation of human rights. Well, ever since the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, political violations of human rights have been brought to the awareness of world public opinion. This has brought to light how serious and widespread are the everyday violations of the fundamental rights of human beings through power politics and unjust authorities, through hate and fratricide. For example, the growing use of systematic torture under dictatorship is a terrifying indication of the fact that the Declaration of Human Rights and its public acceptance have not in themselves created a new humanity among the nations. And this is a very sad phenomenon of the 20th century. At the end of the 19th century, the use of systematic torture was on the decline, and it's much more widespread today than it was 70 years ago. But nevertheless, the Declaration of Human Rights sharpens people's conscience and renders any inhumanity illegitimate, and that is a positive point of the General Declaration of Human Rights. Moreover, since the discussion of the International Covenants of 66, it has become clear that human rights are not only violated but also abused. They are abused whenever they are used ideologically to justify private interests over against the rights of other human beings. They are abused whenever they are divided up and it is pretended that only one part of them stand for human rights in their totality. It is then that we see the birth of individual egoism, national arrogance, humanity's imperialism over against nature, and the absolutism of the present generation over against future generations. The increasing ideological abuse of human rights is a further indication that just declarations and ratifications alone do not create true humanity among human beings. Nevertheless, it must be acknowledged that insight into the indivisible totality of human rights sharpens the consciences and the sense of responsibility of people for each other. Now, Christian theology uses the word sin to describe people's inhumanity, as is made manifest in the continued violations and abuse, for example, of human rights. According to the testimony of the Bible, human beings have themselves failed to come up to their original destiny to live as God's image on earth, and they still fail to do so today. They wanted to be like God and thereby lost their true humanness. Enmity, therefore, characterizes humanity's relationship to nature, and with Cain's murder of his brother begins a history of a humanity that does not want to be its brother's keeper. And so people's sin perverts their relationships with God, their Creator, with their fellow humans, their neighbors, and with nature, their home. God to them becomes a judge, fellow human beings become their enemies, and they become estranged from nature. Today, fear and aggression dominate a divided and hostile humanity, which is on the way totally to destroy itself and the earth. Human rights can only be realized when and in so far as the justification of unjust human beings and the renewal of their humanness by God takes place. There, the claim of God upon human beings is realized in the midst of a sinful humanity. The Christian faith recognizes and proclaims that God, through Jesus Christ, justifies unjust human beings and renews them to their true humanness. Through the incarnation of Christ, God restores to human beings who want to be like God what they left behind, namely their true humanity, which they had abandoned. Through the death of Christ, God takes the judgment of the people's sin on himself and reconciles them to himself. Through the raising of Christ from the dead, God makes real his claim upon people in that he justifies them. And through the outpouring of his Spirit on all flesh, God renews his image on earth, unites a divided humanity, and liberates his creation from the shadow of evil. In the coming of his kingdom, God will ultimately glorify his right, justify human beings, and transfigure creation. So God's claim upon human beings in this world of sin and inhumanity is, for Christianity, revealed through the gospel of Christ, as Paul says in Romans 1, 16 and 17. Because the divine right of grace is proclaimed to all people through this gospel, the God-given dignity of each and every person is proclaimed in conjunction with it. And where this dignity is revealed, the fundamental human rights are also made to come in force. On the strength of the gospel, human rights in a hostile and inhuman world are first and foremost made real through the service of reconciliation, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5. How does this take place? The service of reconciliation and human rights restored through the service. Faith, I believe, separates the human person from the inhuman sin. Love accepts the person and forgives the sin. And hope perceives the human future of the person and opens up new life. In this way, through faith, love, and hope, humanity, once betrayed and lost, is restored to the people. Through the service of reconciliation, human dignity and right are restored in this inhuman world. Wherever people's dignity is recognized and their right restored, there this service of reconciliation takes place. Reconciliation is nothing less than the justifying justice of God. It is a power of the new creation in this twisted world. And that is how God realizes his claim upon human beings. Now, for the sake of reconciliation, one can therefore forgo one's own right. For the sake of the neighbor's right, one can suffer up to the point of giving one's life. Selflessness and sacrifice in the service of reconciliation of the world with God are always also selflessness and sacrifice in the service devoted to the true humanity and dignity of people. Christians have the divine calling to bring the right of reconciliation to bear on the worldwide struggles for privileges and power, in which they are witnesses to the future and agents of hope of mankind. For with the right to reconciliation, there begins here and now a process in which the present unrecognizable world changes into a world that will be seen to be a human world loved by God. The experience of reconciliation turns enemies into friends, as we know, and working at reconciliation opens up the future of life to people who are threatened by death. Sacrifices in the service of reconciliation are the seed of hope. Without reconciliation, the humanization of situations as they are is impossible. Without the humanization, reconciliation remains ineffective. So reconciliation and change, realization of human rights, belong together. And together only they bring humanness in this world. It is a task of Christians in the existing world conflicts in which they live to proclaim the gospel of justification, to live the liberating faith, to exercise the ministry of reconciliation, and to give in their congregations a demonstration of a reconciled humanity in the fellowship of men and women, Jews and Gentiles, slaves and freemen. It is when Christians fulfill their specifically Christian tasks that they serve the realization of humanity of all people. So by proclaiming God's justifying justice, they proclaim the dignity of human beings. By practicing the right of grace, they practice basic human rights. The Christian faith, therefore, does not excuse us from the struggle of recognition and realization of human rights, but rather leads us into this very struggle. The community which calls Jesus the Son of Man suffers under the ongoing inhumanity and dehumanization of human beings, and in its prayers turns this suffering into a painful awareness. And therefore, at the end, let me say, but only at the end, and as a means to work for the justification of unjust human beings and for the recognition of the dignity of human beings and the realization of human rights and duties, therefore, Christianity needs what we call the right of the freedom of religion. Christianity understands itself as a witness to the three in one God who liberates human beings from inward and outward inhumanity, who allows them to live in his covenant, leads them to the glory of his kingdom. Christians, therefore, stand up for the dignity of human beings out of which emerge their rights and duties. For the sake of God, they will stand up with all means at their disposal, acting as well as suffering, for the dignity of human beings and their rights as the image of God, and for their service to humanity of persons and communities. They need something. They need, first, the right to religious freedom, second, the right to form a community, and third, the right to public speech and action. But these rights, which Christianity must demand and must have to for this service of reconciliation, right to religious freedom, right to form a community, right to public speech and action, can be legitimized only insofar as Christianity in itself works for God's claim upon human beings, the dignity of human beings, and the rights and the human rights and duties. And therefore, we in this study, we put these rights of religious freedom, etc., at the end to have it legitimized by what the Christian work for human rights and the acknowledgement of human dignity is all about. Thank you very much. Here I should.